and call for the purposes of the audit record, State of Texas versus $71,404 in U.S. currency, cause number 19310CV. If you all could make your announcements, please.
Good morning, Mr. Gonzalez, on behalf of the State of Texas.
Morning, Mr. Gonzalez.
Good morning, Mr. Jernigan.
Mr. Jernigan, how are you this morning?
Very well.
Good, you all can be seated. For those of you new to the third court, each side will be allocated 20 minutes to argue your case. I assume you've gotten with the clerk and set aside how much time you want for rebuttal.
I have not, Your Honor, but we'd ask for 5 minutes.
Okay, so we'll give you the standard rebuttal. As you're probably familiar, we have this lighting system, and so when the yellow light comes on, that means that you have 2 minutes within your allotted time left. When the red light comes on, that means that you're out of time and you need to look to the court to continue, and certainly we'll be friendly to that if you're in the middle of answering a question or finishing a thought. We want to get all the knowledge that you have today. By way of housekeeping, if anyone in the audience has a cell phone, page, or other device, now would be a good time to turn them off, Mr. Dick. And with that, we will hear from the attorneys. Mr. Gonzalez.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This is an interlocutory appeal from the trial court's denial of a plea to the jurisdiction. It was the State of Texas's plea to the jurisdiction in connection with an asset forfeiture case, which is an in rem proceeding. The issue that's before this court is the issue of when does a trial court lose in rem jurisdiction over an asset forfeiture case. And specifically in this case, did the trial court in this case lose jurisdiction over the case prior to the hearing and the granting of the motion for new trial? This is, since it involves a question of jurisdiction, it is a question of law and subject to de novo review. And in the state's brief, I've set forth two possible tests for determining when a trial court has lost or still has in rem jurisdiction. I will confess that the state of the law in this area is not as clear as I would have liked it to have been. But there's basically two tests. The first test is the traditional test, which has been used for many, many years, and quite possibly is still the law in the state of Texas with regard to asset forfeiture in rem proceedings. And that test is whether the trial court has acquired and maintained control of the rest, the subject matter of the proceeding.
Mr. Gonzalez, as you go through, could you sort of educate us on the interplay between the jurisdictional concept that you're talking about and the court's plenary power, given that here they signed an order on the matter that they had jurisdiction over at one point?
Absolutely. So the court maintains plenary jurisdiction subject to it's still having subject matter jurisdiction over the subject matter of the lawsuit. I think in order for a trial court, in order for any court to rule over the parties on a case, it must have, that's a preliminary question, it must have jurisdiction.
Isn't there some case law out there, though, that once the court has jurisdiction at the outset, there's a presumption that it continues to, and that the party's conduct can't really take the court's jurisdiction away?
So with regard to in rem proceedings, the question is up in the air. There is some case law that does definitely say that the court maintains jurisdiction once it has acquired custody or control over the rest. It maintains jurisdiction no matter whether the rest is later dispersed or lost, and that would be the line of thinking behind the Republic National Bank case from the U.S. Supreme Court in 1992, which is cited in my brief. And in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court, I think, that's an admiralty case, arguably distinguishable from an asset forfeiture case. I'm not sure whether that is the law or not with regard to asset forfeiture. But arguably, I think there's been some unpublished opinions that have made reference to the abolition of the no rest, no case rule. And if that's
reading that, I was worried that we've been pronouncing rest incorrectly all these years.
And it may be that I'm pronouncing it incorrectly as well, Your Honor.
I was hoping it wasn't race.
Race, no case.
Right.
No. Okay.
I don't know.
Well, that I'll be honest with you. That comes from my Spanish background, so I have familiarity with the Spanish language. So
I think you had it right.
That's the way it would be pronounced in Spanish. So. It would so the U.S. Supreme Court kind of advocated the abolition of the no rest no case rule, they said once the trial court acquires control over the subject matter of the case, it maintains it. Doesn't matter if they lose it. The exception is when something happens that would result in a useless judgment. And so that would be the second case. And so should this court decide that the Republic National Bank case, the U.S. Supreme Court's law is now the law of the state of Texas with regard to asset forfeiture cases, and should this court decide that the judgment in this case would not be a useless judgment, then I concede that the trial court still would have jurisdiction, and we would have to go back and try this case. The motion for new trial, the order granting motion for new trial would be valid, and we'd have to go back and try the case.
And so, kind of touching on the useless judgment idea, we're dealing with money. We're not dealing with a car, like
correct.
The case out of, I think it was Corpus. We're dealing with money that's fungible. And so I know that y'all are y'all really arguing that, well, that dollar that we got was literally spent somewhere else, and therefore we have no rest? I mean, it seems to me that money's fungible, and you can, you know, whether it's that same dollar or it's another dollar you have in your account.
Well, and that's a good point, Your Honor. And I would say with regard to the district attorney, I think I noted in my reply brief that the district attorney has looking for the correct word, encumbered that amount that was dispersed to the district attorney's office and basically set it aside.
Okay.
And so that district attorney's office does have that money available. We concede that. Whether the sheriff's office does or the district clerk's office does or the constable's office does, I honestly cannot answer that question.
I don't really think constables had money that they haven't spent yet.
Yeah, exactly. Or sheriff.
I mean, it's a four-wheeler or some sort of fancy flashing lights on somebody's truck by this point in time.
And some of these offices, and with regard to the constable and district clerk, those were fees that were paid to them for service of citation and for filing fees and so forth. And so what happens to the money that goes into their fee accounts, I really honestly can't speak to that. But it wouldn't surprise me if that money is spent pretty quickly.
What about the defense makes this argument that all of those entities that received the money are also sort of within the purview of supervision of the district court? Is there anything there? Should somebody be trying to go through the district court to bring those folks in or involve them, or is it proper to just have the DA here today?
Well, so I think that would be the distinction between an in rem proceeding and an in personam proceeding. And I think if the court acquired in personam jurisdiction over the sheriff or over the district clerk or the constable, then certainly the trial court could issue an order ordering them to return the money. Without them being under the specific jurisdiction of the court in this case, I'm really not sure how a trial court can do that. And perhaps Judge Kennan would disagree with me that he has authority to do that, and that y'all may decide that is the case. But I just have a hard time seeing how parties that are not a party to the lawsuit can be brought in order to do something. I think what the appellee argues is that basically we're all under the umbrella of the state of Texas. And to the extent that we see that in, say, for example, like Brady issues, where the state knowledge is imputed to the state of Texas with regard to whatever any peace officer knows out there about a specific case, that certainly works in that scenario. And I think the case law and the statutes 39.14 of the Code of Criminal Procedure provide for that. They provide that in a Brady situation, it's so serious that the ones doing the investigation, in fact, are the officers out on the street, on the ground, and whatever information they have should be imputed to the attorney for the state. With regard to asset forfeiture situations, I think it's a very different situation. I think Chapter 59 of the Code of Criminal Procedure makes very clear that once currency is deposited and then dispersed, it goes to very specific accounts with very specific control of those accounts placed in different hands, and it makes a distinction between the state of Texas and local law enforcement agencies.
But in the Houston case, which was the state versus, I think, $2 million, didn't the money go to the was it the U.S. Customs?
I believe it was the federal government, Your Honor.
Right. So, I mean, and the court there decided, granted it's Houston, but the court there decided, no, you get it back. So under the idea of this is not even all state, and you know,
right. Statewide,
government, this is the federal government, the court made them return the money.
And certainly there's exceptions. In situations where money has been dispersed fraudulently, improperly, accidentally, and if that were the case here, then I would agree that the trial court retains jurisdiction over the subject matter of the lawsuit. And certainly that's one of the arguments of Appley. They've argued that it was improperly dispersed because the agreed judgment was not, in fact, agreed to. And so I spent quite a bit of time in the state's brief demonstrating how at the time that the agreed judgment was entered, it was a valid enforceable judgment. The attorney for the appellee, Mr. Greg Terra, was presumed to have authority to enter into that judgment. The trial court was required to act on that presumption. He had no evidence to the contrary that Mr. Terra did not have authority. The state had no information that Mr. Terra did not have authority. So as far as we were concerned, as far as the trial court was concerned, it was a valid, enforceable judgment. It was an agreed judgment. No supersedious was filed. Once it was signed by the trial court, it was an enforceable judgment. The statute, the asset forfeiture statute, requires the state of Texas, the attorney representing the state, to disperse money pursuant to the judgment and pursuant to local agreement.
Would your analysis be different if it would have been contested? I mean, as part of your analysis, well, it was an agreed judgment versus, let's say that y'all had a trial, it was contested, and you won, and they obviously had a right to appeal or ask for a new trial. Does that play, or is the position, the state's position, or the DA's position that, you know, somehow this is different because there was an agreed judgment?
There would be different considerations if it was a contested case, but I think the result would be the same. I think if we go to trial against someone, we take a judgment, and the parties choose not to appeal or are awaiting appeal, filing a notice of appeal, or they file a notice of appeal without posting supersedious, I think the state could go forward. Now, would we? Honestly, I do not think that we would. I think we would wait until the judgment was final, completely final, and not subject to any further appeals. Had Mr. Terra had come to the state in this case and advised us that there was an objection from his client, certainly we would not have gone forward to disperse the money.
And I think that was a short period of time. Remind me of the timeline there.
So the timeline, as I recall, I believe there was the judgment, the agreed judgment was signed on February 13th. On February 27th, 14 days later, the money was disbursed. And I believe on March 8th is the first time that we heard any objection from the appellee.
But Mr. Gonzalez, so this was part of a plea. I mean, there was a criminal case that was going on, and there was a civil forfeiture, and there was a plea that had been struck. And at the time of the plea, if I understand the record, the defendant said, wait, I'm not sure I want to plead because I want to speak to my immigration attorney, correct?
That's correct.
So the plea did not go forward.
That's correct.
So shouldn't they have had some notice that maybe part of the plea, which is the agreed forfeiture, might not really be part of the plea anymore?
In a perfect world, Your Honor, I would agree with you. I think if the attorneys in any given office communicated with one another as they should, I think we might have a different situation here. That did not happen in this case. I think Ms. Chapman advised the trial court at the hearing that she had no knowledge. She did not know about any type of objection until the motion for new trial was filed. And so, you know, they are separate proceedings. I understand what Your Honor is asking, and it's a valid point, but they are separate proceedings, and I think that it would be very possible for someone to reconsider their decision to enter a plea on one case and want to go forward on the asset forfeiture case and another case. And ultimately, we still don't know what Appley is going to choose to do. His criminal case remains pending. Obviously, the immigration consequences were a concern for him, and I understand that. That happens all the time in the trial courts.
Well, it's a little, Ken, I think we've had cases here before where someone entered a plea but didn't realize the potential ramifications of the immigration consequences, so this is almost akin to that. He may have wanted to enter the plea but didn't realize it meant that he forfeited this money.
That may well be. Immigration consequences, I know when the U.S. Supreme Court decided Padilla, they said it was not going to open the floodgates. Prior to coming here to Williamson County, I worked in Cameron County on the border, and I have a very different opinion about the floodgates being opened on that issue.
I want to ask about you said that the statute requires y'all to disperse the money. Is there a time frame that you're required to disperse it by?
There's not a time frame under which we're required. It just says that we shall disperse it in accordance with the judgment and the local agreement. I think a reasonable amount of time could be implied. Could we have waited? Should we have waited? I think we could have waited. Had we known there were some objections, we certainly would have waited. We would not want to be accused in this situation of having acted improperly, having knowledge that he withdrew his consent to the agreed judgment, and we acted improperly. We simply did not have any knowledge. We thought it was agreed at that time in our office. It was the policy of our office on agreed judgments to disperse immediately. Now we've changed that policy, and now we have defense attorneys coming back and complaining that now we wait on the disbursement. So, I mean, we can't win either way.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Good morning, Your Honors. Morning. May I proceed?
Yes.
So I want to touch on what we were just left with, which was basically an admission that if they had to do it all over again, they would. In this case, all we're asking is to return to the point that we were on February 13th. We're not asking for Mr. Alonzo Carbajal to get his money back. We just want the money to go back into the DA text pool account until his criminal case is concluded. And if we prevail in his criminal case, he gets his money back. If we lose, they get his money. This was a perfect storm of everything that could have gone wrong to my client. He is a legal resident who doesn't speak English. That's apparent from the record. He was arrested for having cash. The PC affidavit is, at the best, very weak on probable cause. And his lawyer forfeited his money without his knowledge, without his agreement. And during the motion for new trial period, you know, my client didn't wait around and say, oh, okay, well, you know, I don't trust this lawyer now. I'm going to go wait, you know, 30 days or 45 days and go hire another lawyer. He went immediately, found a new lawyer. She's the one who informed him, by the way, your money's been given away. And they immediately filed a motion for a new trial. And with respect to this issue about jurisdiction and where this money is and whether the court has lost jurisdiction, I filed a motion to abate in this case so that we could have a hearing so everybody could come in and raise their hand and say, yes, I still have the money. No, I don't still have the money. In response to that motion, the state, in their brief, said there's no need for an abatement because here's where it is. The sheriff has this much, the constable has this much, the district clerk has this much, okay? So now, fast forward, we're here, and suddenly nobody knows where the money is. And I think, as y'all are aware, Williamson County is a small place. I mean, all of these elected officials know each other. They see each other. I mean, you could go to an event in almost any night of the week and see the sheriff, the constable, the district attorney, right? It's not like, I mean, the DA's office is across the street from the sheriff's office. If somebody wants to know where the money is, they can pick up the phone and say, hello, my fellow elected official, can you please tell me if you still have $57,000? And to your point, Justice Triana, I mean, money is fungible. It's not, we don't have to show that it's this dollar or a different dollar that can be returned to the text pool account. The trial court's order was very clear. And just to back up, this whole issue of jurisdiction, really the main issue in this case is whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in granting this motion for new trial. Because that's the order that we're here about.
Okay,
today.
So let me ask you about that. Mm-hmm. Because Mr. Gonzalez says that we look at this de novo, that it's a question of law. Do you believe that the proper way to look at it is an abuse of discretion? Standard of review?
I think there's two issues, because they've now raised a plea to the jurisdiction. At the time of the motion for new trial hearing, you know, they argued some jurisdictional issues, but the motion for new trial was what was granted. So I think that is looked under abuse of discretion. If you want to do a de novo review of this jurisdictional issue, I would point to the case that you spoke of earlier, Justice Triano, which is the state versus $2 million. In that case, the exception to this whole jurisdiction, you know, no race, no case, all of that stuff, is found in that case. And I know it's from Houston, but it very clearly articulates and stands for a proposition of fairness, that if your money is given away improperly, fraudulently, that the trial court retains jurisdiction over it. And in that case, the woman who sought to get her money back, it was like $1 million, she didn't have knowledge that it had been forfeited, which is exactly what happened here. And the court found that it was improperly forfeited.
But that was not an agreed judgment. I mean, what do we do with a lawyer who purports to be signing for his client? I mean, I don't think that there's anything, you're not claiming that they did anything improper in forfeiting it. I mean, they had a valid judgment, correct?
I, to the extent that they had an agreed final judgment, I think that's right. I do think they did something improper in dispersing the funds before the 30 days for filing a motion for a new trial.
Is there anything expired in the statute that requires them to wait?
No, just our Texas rules of civil procedure. The problem with the agreed judgment is that Mr. Tara didn't have the authority from his client to enter into that judgment. He didn't go over the document with him. He didn't have his client sign it. My client didn't even know about it. And so in that regard, there are exceptions to, you know, whether a judgment is actually agreed to. I cited some cases in my brief where if the lawyer doesn't have actual authority to enter into a settlement agreement, then it's not an agreed judgment.
How do we find for you on that argument without undermining the sanctity of judgments? I mean, if we can't let the system trust the signature and the agreement of a lawyer to a judgment, where does that leave us?
Well, I think it leaves us in a couple of positions. I think, first of all, unfortunately, we're all aware that there are lawyers that don't do what they're supposed to do. And so we need to have some sort of redress for that. And it shouldn't be, you know, held against my client that his lawyer entered into an agreement without his knowledge.
Well, should it be your client seeking redress from the lawyer instead of from the system?
Well, the thing is, Judge, we're not actually asking for, and that may happen. But right now, all we're asking is for the return of the money to the text pool account. So seeking redress from him, I think, would be a little bit premature. But I think when we're talking about undermining the sanctity of agreed judgments, you know, some agreed judgments are entered into fraudulently. Some are without knowledge. And so I don't think that it would undermine, first of all, a great number of agreed judgments. And I also think that if the 30 days had been enforced or waited, you know, if the state had waited, we wouldn't be in this position. We would be in a position where the money would still be in the account. We could have ferreted out all this information that Mr. Tara did not convey to his client, now my client. And so we'd be in a very different position.
Do we wait for appeals as well?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I mean, if you want them to wait for the motion for new trial period to run, do you also wait for the appellate deadlines to run? I mean, where do you draw the line on exhausting the review remedies?
Motion for new trial, because that's the time when you can elicit testimony, you know, do whatever you need to do to perfect your record, to glean facts or evidence that weren't available or presented at trial.
Well, and wouldn't, when you appeal it, then you would have to set, you know, I would assume that there'd be a supersedious bond. I mean, in order to prevent that from being dispersed at that moment, although the U.S. Supreme Court case said that no supersedious bond was required in that case.
That's right. And I think that's going to be an issue further down the road, is that Timms v. Indiana case from earlier this year. And so, you know, and the whole point is my client wasn't even given the opportunity to file a supersedeas bond because he didn't even know his money had been forfeited. I keep wondering the whole time I've been on this case why the state wants to enforce a forfeiture of a judgment where clearly the defendant didn't have knowledge. They can put the money back in the account and we can make this back to where it should have been from the beginning, back to a point of fairness. We'll go litigate the criminal case and then whoever wins gets the money. I mean, it's not, it really is about fairness, but in addition, it's about the case law that supports doing this. That Houston case, the state versus $2 million, it is on point. And even if you want to use this Republic...
Except that wasn't an agreed order.
It wasn't an agreed order.
I mean, I think the sticking point, and I think we're, you know, Justice Rose, I agree with him, which is we don't want every agreed judgment, you know, to open the door, going back to what it's going to do, to have somebody who did know, if facts were known, to come behind their lawyer's signature and say, I didn't know about that. I did not get permission to do that.
And there's a very easy way to do that in asset forfeiture cases is to have the client sign the judgment as well. Or put on the record during the plea, you've discussed this asset forfeiture with your lawyer, have you not? Yes, I agree to it. Yes, I do. I mean, there are ways to get around, just like guilty pleas. I mean, people come in and say, you know, are we going to say, oh, you can't claim that your plea was involuntary? I mean, people go in and say, yes, I did this. I plead guilty. I understand all of this. And then come back and say, wait, I want to withdraw my guilty plea. I mean, we allow them to do that. In this case, what happened was so fundamentally unfair to Mr. Alonzo Carbajal. And I think that this is the only case that I know of like this in Williamson County. It's not like this happens once a week where, you know, a lawyer comes in and says, a defendant comes in and says, you know, I changed my mind or I didn't agree to this. I didn't give my client authority to do this. In fact, I think this is the only case in Williamson County where that's happened. And as the state, revealed to the court, they've changed their provisions now to wait the 30 days. I know that in our local defense bar, we have sort of alerted the troops that, hey, let's get our clients to sign these forfeitures so we're not in the same position. So I don't think it's going to open the floodgates, as was discussed earlier. The other issue that comes up in this case is a discussion of whether or not there was, there's a discussion about whether there is evidence against my client that would point to him being guilty of money laundering. Of course, we assert that there's not. The state points to the issue that my client was arrested and found to be driving a stolen vehicle. I just want to clear that up for the record. The state is on notice that my client was not aware that the vehicle was stolen. He actually registered the car, and he actually called the district attorney's office to try to get it back. There were no narcotics found in Mr. Carbajal's truck, and I think that's important to know because we feel that there is a good chance that we will prevail in the criminal case, and so therefore we're going to be in a position like the Timms case where we would have to go back and sue the state for the money when the simple fix right now is just to put the money back into the text pool account and let's litigate the criminal case.
What wasn't there concessions by your client though that he was engaging in criminal activity?
No, there weren't, Your Honor. What happened was his attorney testified that when they were going over the video and watching the stop that he made a reference to my client's, whether he was guilty or not, and he, according to Mr. Tara, that my client nodded in affirmance. all of the conversations between Mr. Tara and my client were done without an interpreter. My client doesn't speak English. It's indicated in the record that he tries to comprehend as much as he can, but often doesn't. He uses a Google translator to try to understand what's going on. So I think it's pretty weak to, for Mr. Tara, his lawyer, to say, you know what, there's no problem here because he's guilty. But no, my client did not concede that he was in doing any kind of money laundering or drug trafficking.
When we look at sort of the standard of, was it accidentally, improperly, or fraudulently released, I mean, who is the focus of that conduct? Isn't the focus of that on the people that released it? And what knowledge did they have that the agreed judgment wasn't good?
My reading of the cases, Your Honor, is it's whether or not the person whose money it is had knowledge that it was being forfeited. I don't remember any cases that focused on the conduct of the person actually releasing the money, because I think they would have knowledge that they did that. And in this case, I'm not trying to say that the state knew that my client didn't agree to it, knew that there was something shady going on. I'm not trying to say that.
So what was the, you don't seem to be arguing accident or fraud, it was improper.
It was improper.
What was the improper impropriety in releasing the funds?
That Mr. Tara signed an agreed judgment without the knowledge of his client.
So the improper act was on the part of your client's former lawyer. It wasn't on the part of the people releasing the funds.
I think it's twofold. I think that it is on the part of Mr. Tara, but I also think it's on the state, because they released the money before the time for motion for new trial expired. And when the trial court asked the DA's office, the state, how in the world can you say that an agreed final judgment can't be challenged during the 30-day period? And they said, because it's agreed, and that's what we do. I mean, he asked him three times, and that was the answer, because it's agreed and that's what we do. Now we find out that's not what we do anymore. So that, I think it's twofold. I think it is on the part of the state, whether knowingly or, I mean, they did disperse the money knowing the 30 days hadn't expired. And it is largely on the part of Mr. Tara. But I think what is troubling about this case is, once everybody got knowledge, once everybody learned what had happened, it was still within the 30 days, and the parties could have agreed to this, to put the money back. I mean, there's no harm, no foul in putting the money back in the text pool account and then dispersing it at the proper time after the criminal case has been litigated. It's not like, and the problem is, if we do prevail in the criminal case, that's Mr. Carbajal's money that the state has now held, knowing that it was taken without his knowledge, for this whole time period while he's litigating his criminal case. I just sort of scratch my head every time I think about this, about why, when we were still in the 30-day period, they just didn't agree to put the money back. You know, and let's litigate the criminal case. So that, I mean, I think that would have been the just remedy, and unfortunately it's been kicked down the road to you guys to decide whether or not an agreed judgment that wasn't entered into with the client's knowledge and executed before the 30 days for a motion for new trial expired is okay. And, you know, it's our position that it's not. I mean, it comes down to a taking of someone's money without due process. And I think that the issue of jurisdiction and whether, I think in a lot of ways the Republic, the Admiralty case or whatever, does apply in this case, because it's that likewise says that the trial court still has jurisdiction over the value of an object that was taken. So they can still report and they can still order people under their jurisdiction, parties, whatever, to return money that, or return the value of whatever was taken. And in this court, that's why I included in my brief the argument that the trial court has jurisdiction over all of these parties, the sheriff, the constable, the district clerk, and the DA's office. And I think it's interesting, in the state's brief, they spent a lot of time trying to distinguish between...
So what's the meaning of that, though? I mean, are you saying the trial court could just order those entities to give back the money?
He did, in his order. In fact, the order, I have it here, it says the fund should be returned to the district attorney text pool account from the district clerk, precinct 3 constable, sheriff, and the district attorney. And interestingly, in the record, you'll find that it was Ms. Pat Chapman, the prosecutor, that asked the court to include that language in the order. So he wrote it in during the hearing. But they spent a lot of time trying to say, well, you know, we're the state, but we're not the state. Local law enforcement is different. I mean, let's be very clear that the sheriff obviously is an agent of the state. The precinct constable is an agent of the state. I mean, we go into court all the time with agents of the state. So I think to try to distinguish them and say, well, no, I mean, we're different. I mean, this case is called the state of Texas versus $71,404, and we have the state here. So I anticipate they may argue that. And so the Code of Criminal Procedure is very clear that they're all agents of the state. And so in the long answer to your question then, Justice Rose, is that yes, he can order them to return the money, and that's why I included that whole section in my brief.
Okay.
So if there's no further questions, I thank you for granting oral argument in this case.
Thank you, Ms. Jernigan. Rebuttal, Mr. Gonzalez?
Just briefly in reply. So the district attorney's office is here representing the state as per statute. Chapter 59 of the Code of Criminal Procedure specifically says that in this case, the district attorney's office is the attorney representing the state. It doesn't necessarily mean that we are the state. I invite the court to go back and look carefully at my reply brief at the Chapter 59. There's numerous specific distinctions within Chapter 59. Concerning who the state is, who local law enforcement is, who the attorney representing the state is. And it doesn't always have to be the district attorney's office. In other situations, it could be another prosecuting attorney. That said, I would just say that I don't think that Ms. Jernigan has advised this court under what theory all of us are the state. I mean, she says that the sheriff's office goes to court as a witness for the state, and they do. But that doesn't make them an agent of the state. The county's in the middle of federal litigation right now here in Austin as to determine whether the district attorney and other various officials are members of the county or members of the state or members of of something else, you know, some special districts. And so it's a question that is very much up in the air. And for purposes of budgeting, it's something that we get frustrated with all the time. With the county, because we're not. Mr. Dick is the district attorney for the 26th Judicial District. He's not a county employee, and yet he's subject to the county budget restraints. And so it's a very complex question, I'll suffice it to say. And I will say this in response to Ms. Jernigan's argument as to why we're not just agreeing to do it over. If the district attorney's office was in possession of the entire $71,404, I think we probably would, out of an effort of trying to do the right thing, say we have the money, it's still within the jurisdiction, let's do it again. But the problem is we do not have all the money. And although Mr. Dick may be able to pick up the phone and call Sheriff Chody or call Ms. Lisa David, the district clerk, or whatever, that doesn't mean that they're automatically going to say, oh, sure, you can have some of our money back. I mean, it's what's theirs is theirs, and what's not ours is not ours. And so that's the reason that we've gone forward. We just don't have the money with us. We made that very clear at the time of the hearing on the motion for new trial. We don't have the money.
I know you said that you have a policy now.
We've changed the policy, correct.
I want to talk just real briefly about that. Let's say that we were to rule in your favor, wouldn't we almost be creating an incentive for you to get rid of money as quickly as possible? I mean, regardless of your policy, right?
I think that's a fair point. I think it would be. I mean, there's no reason why we have to wait 30 days. I know Ms. Jernigan thinks otherwise, but there's no reason we have to wait 30 days if supersedious has not been filed, whether it's an agreed judgment or contested judgment. Now, we might want to wait. There's other reasons why we might want to wait, or there's reasons why we might not want to wait, given what the decision of this court is. But for us to decide to disperse a valid enforceable judgment immediately on day one after the trial court has signed it, there's nothing improper about that. In this specific case, the fact that they allege that Mr. Carbajal did not have knowledge of the execution of the agreed judgment and that Mr. Terra did not have authority to sign it, that might, and I make this point in the reply brief, that might at the most make it avoidable judgment if they were able to demonstrate through clear evidence that Mr. Terra did not have authority to sign it, but it did not make it a void judgment at the time that we dispersed it. It was a valid enforceable judgment. And so it is a perfect storm. I'll agree with Ms. Jernigan on that point. It's a perfect storm of circumstances, not likely to ever happen again, but it happened in this case. And we're doing the best with what we have. I just want to address briefly that Ms. Jernigan stated that Ms. Carbajal did not have due process. And I would disagree with that statement. I believe he did. He had an attorney. He had an attorney that he consulted with numerous times. He had an attorney that represented on the record that Mr. Carbajal had admitted guilt to him. I know Ms. Jernigan reads the record differently. I disagree with her. I think if you go back and read the record, it was very clear that Mr. Terra stated that. In conclusion, I would just say the state did nothing improper. It was a valid, enforceable judgment at the time we enforced it. And we would ask the court to overrule the trial court's denial of the plea to the jurisdiction.
Thank you, Mr. Gonzalez. Ms. Jernigan, for a well-argued case. The case will be submitted and court will stand in recess.